Wow.
I've been thinking all week about, like, what the walk-up music should be for this episode.
Oh, God.
And in my head, it's, like, the beginning of that one, like, 90s song where he's like,
y'all ready for this?
We didn't sign a contract before
this.
No,
we did not.
We've not discussed our hard limits.
Nope. We actually have also not signed a contract for our friendship, which apparently we should have based on what happened at Drunk Austin. I know. So
wait, do we need to say it out loud that we're equal partners in Beta Mates?
Yeah, now it's on tape.
All right, there it is. A gentleman's agreement.
We should introduce ourselves. I don't even know.
I think we should, ease it. Do it professional.
Yeah, we're going to play it real straight this week.
Welcome to Fated Mates, everyone. I'm Sarah McLean. I write romances and I read them.
And I'm Jen Prokop. I am a romance reader and critic. I'm also, I'm excited.
I should also say I have given a lot of interviews about 50 Shades of Grey over the last decade. And this is the first time that I've ever had a conversation about it in public. Just cash.
So maybe we should tell, you know what might be interesting is to tell our 50 Shades stories, because I'm going to tell you mine, which is...
You start.
Yeah, I'll start. It's a good one. So I, as everyone knows, have read romance my entire life. My son was born in 2003, and for those of you that have had kids, you know that reading afterwards is really hard, right? So there was probably a pretty long period, and there's like sort of this... apocryphal story. This is actually true. He was about 7 years old, and some friends of ours came over with younger kids, and they were like, where's your son? And I was like, I don't know. And then the immediate next thought was, oh my God, I can read again. Mm-hmm. Like, I had been waiting for that window where I didn't need to, like, be with him all the time because he was a baby. And then I sort of felt like that moment is what made me realize, like, it was back. So that was probably 2010 because he was seven. And what happened is I was working at I worked at my current school, and we would go out every once in a while, just like some of the women I worked with, or hang out at like someone's house and have drinks. And my coworker and 50 Shades came up, and my coworker Pam was like, I read it. And I was like, yeah, I read a lot of romance, but I haven't read that. And she gave me her copy. And I came home.
Thanks, Pam.
Yeah, thanks, Pam. And I, and just, she kind of like she was kind of like, I can't believe I'm doing this. But I was like, yeah, sure, I'd like love to read it. And I don't think I read it right away, but it must have been a couple years after
She gave you a print copy.
Yes.
And it was after it came out.
Yeah, it was probably a couple years after it came out. My guess is I don't actually really know exactly when I read it, because I'll be honest, it didn't really... I was like, it was all
right. Was it like already a big deal when you read it?
It was a big deal. So it probably was 20...
But it wasn't like... Was it a big deal in the moment when you read it, or was it after the fact?
I would say in the moment. Right?
All like,
right.
It was probably something... 2012. It was
That's my guess. It was 2012. And I was like, sure. And you know what is really funny? The only thing I remember from my first time reading it was thinking, like, you know, romance has gotten hotter, and I think I like it.
I think a lot of people felt that way.
Yeah. But that was it.
Yeah.
Thanks, Pam.
Thanks, Pam. All right, so my story is very different in that I was already writing romance when it happened. Okay, here's the deal. The Kindle explosion. So I wrote my first book in 2009. It was a YA novel. My second book came out March of 2010. My third book came out October of 2010. I was writing a lot faster then. Mm-hmm. And my fourth book came out May of 2011. So the numbers series 9, 10, and 11 came out March, October, May. Then I was writing, A Rogue by Any Other Name came out. The first book in the Casino series came out early 2012. So I had written three books by the three romance novels by the time 50 Shades happened. And when it first happened, so just to give everybody a little bit of the history, because I feel like we're pretty far away. I want to just say from the start, like, we're reading 50 Shades 10 years after it came out. 10 years ago, I cannot stress enough how much literally all of us were being asked about 50 Shades all the time. Like,
yeah,
you couldn't say to anyone anywhere that you were a romance novelist or that you read romance or that, you know, you were involved in the romance community without somebody wanting to talk to you about this book. There are a lot of reasons why, and I think we're going to get into them. But what I want to say is that in 2011, so the first 50 Shades of Grey was released as an ebook from a publisher in Australia that is now known to be just like a group of friends who were hanging out and like decided they were going to put out these books as publish these books. Publisher in Australia in May of 2011. And that was the first time you could buy them in E. At the time, nobody was reading it in print. Like, they were reading it in E because everybody had just bought their first Kindle. Like, I was reading 50 Shades on the Kindle, my first Kindle, which I got for Christmas of 2010. So when we talk about this as a juggernaut, and we're going to talk about it, we're going to talk about the history and sort of unpack a lot of the book during this episode. But I need to say over and over again that you cannot discount timing. I'm always going to come back to timing on this book, why it worked, why it was so huge, and timing. So I read it because it was my job to read it, because I was a romance novelist. I too wanted to sell 150 million copies of something. And everybody was talking about 50 Shades in and out of the community. It was a hot button text in the community. It was the book everybody associates with romance novels then and now still, I think. We still hear. I was on a panel 3 nights ago, and there was a question about 50 Shades. Like, as a community, I think romance is so interested in moving past 50 Shades and sort of saying, like, we are in a new place now, and we are, right? Generations, we've said 1,000 times on the podcast, like, generations move so fast in romance that there's so little, like, on the reread of this, there is so little of, like, what is romance in 2020 in this book? Like, we really have just evolved out of the 50 Shades world. But it is still the book the rest of the world looks at and says, oh, romance novels like 50 Shades.
Yeah.
Like, romance novels, oh, like Fabio. Like, we don't love that either. But, like, this is the reality. We have these texts. We have Fabio's, like, long blonde hair. And we have 50 Shades. So the history is that it comes out of fanfic. And we are going to have Christina Lauren back on this season to talk about fanfic. And part of the reason why we're so excited about Christina Lauren coming back on is because they, too, came out of the Twilight fanfic sphere, along with Sally Thorne and Tara Sumi and a number of other writers who are still writing and, like, deeply embedded and invested in the romance community. Like, we owe a lot of what we see in romance now today to Stephanie Meyer and the Twilight fanfic universe. And so they're going to come on. We're going to talk about fanfic. We're going to talk about some of the big fanfic communities that have really delivered to romance in the past 10 years. And I'm really excited about that conversation. So, but we can't lose sight of a few things. We can't lose sight of the fact that this book was the first gigantic romance novel of the 21st century. And we can't lose track of the fact that it is also, when you talk about the impact of fanfic on romance, it is impossible to do it without talking about the genesis of 50 Shades, I think.
Maybe this is something we're going to save for later, but, like, and you and I talked about this in a text, right? The things we talk about when we talk about 50 Shades and the things we don't.
That's what, right? I wanted. I want this episode, obviously, we're going to talk about the content of the book, too. But I actually don't think there's as much to talk about the content of the book. Like, we are talking about, when we talk about 50 Shades, we are talking about something very different than, like, the words on the page. And that's what I'm interested in.
Yeah. And in some ways, this isn't going to be like a typical episode. We're not going to like do a plot summary.
Go watch the movie.
Yeah. Right. So I read it that one time. I did not read any of the sequels. And in fact, this week I went and read I read the beginning of number two, mm-hmm. because I was really interested. Like, did I try it? Like, what happened? And I must have started it because I remembered why I was like, this is dumb. It's like 5 days later and she gets back with him. And I was like, wait, why even? Right? Like, what is going on? Right? And I think the thing, so I think, you know, for me, we're also just going to talk about it as this one thing. I don't have a lot. I don't really know or care, right, about books two and three, for like me personally as a reader.
No, I mean, I've said a lot of times that when you talk about 50 Shades in the world, right, when you talk about 50 Shades as a cultural text, you kind of have to talk about it as all three, because it is, you know, all three. But I think a lot of people were very served by book one and didn't really care to go further.
Well, so maybe we should start off talking about the way in which it's not a classic romance novel, of course, well, is that
it doesn't end happily.
And you know what I really found myself thinking about this time was how much it reminded me actually of the movie 9 1/2 Weeks. And also Pretty Woman. Like, I felt like there was a lot of ways in which this is grounded, not just in Twilight, but in, like, pop culture in general. Especially pop culture about, like, women and their lovers. And in 9 1/2 Weeks, they have this really steamy affair, and she walks away from it at the end of it. It's just this shooting star, right? And, then Pretty Woman is, like, a very much the same story, right? Rich man, poor girl, like sort of that I'm going to pluck you out of obscurity and my attention to you will make you in some ways. Like, so, you know, to me, I'm just like, yeah, but it's like not even really a romance in that way. There's not really the classic romance plot. It's really erotic romance in the sense that it's about their sexual relationship and they're fundamentally really not really that well suited for each other.
No, they're not compatible.
Because his kink is something she finds abnormal.
Yeah, which is a big problem.
Yeah, it is.
I want to give a couple more, like, historical facts about 50 Shades, one of which will, at the end, I'll tack on to what you're saying about his kink. So it was written as fanfic. It was called Master of the Universe. She was named on the fanfic boards. E.L. James was called Snow Queen's Ice Dragon. That was her name.
Awesome.
And it was this massive behemoth of a piece of fanfic, which then she rewrote for publication. And I don't know this for sure, but I assume chopped up into three pieces. Like, I don't think she was, like, continuing the story. I think the story was complete
Where to cut it, yeah.
So she decided where to cut it. I want to highlight the fact that the end of 50 Shades is a cliffhanger. She leaves him, right? We have seen this work over and over again in other romances. Like, there is a very classic, I mean, Jen's on the record. There is a very classic indie romance trope where you chop your story up into three pieces and end each one on a cliffhanger and sell the book separately.
And that comes from 50 Shades, right?
It has to, yes. I mean, prior to 50 Shades, there wasn't enough money in the indie romance hill. I mean, that's not fair. Actually, I shouldn't say that, because prior to 50 Shades, there was Barbara Freethy, who we've talked about on the podcast before, that Barbara is the best-sellingest author on Amazon ever.
Yeah.
Barbara was a contemporary romance writer who, in 2009 or 2008, 2009, right when the Kindle just was a seed of a interest to the world, she sort of said, oh, wait a second, I'm going to get all my rights back to my old Harlequins. I don't even know if they were Harlequins, but to my old contemporaries, right. And I'm going to put them all up. And she had this massive backlist that was suddenly hers and available as content on your new Kindle, which at the time there was no KU. Like, you have to think, like, 12, 13 years ago, what we know now as indie publishing just didn't exist.
I mean, it made itself, right?
Bella Andre was hustling. She did not get her backlist back. So she wrote her backlist in the first year. I think she wrote a book every 7 weeks and popped them all up online. And she talk about somebody who hustled and built herself a really wonderful, by the way, I think Bella's such a skilled writer, a wonderful backlist. And those two were doing great. There were several other authors who were, there were lots of other authors who were doing okay. And then in comes not just Stephanie, other people too, but 50 Shades somehow blows the doors off, right? Somehow it becomes the book that everyone was reading. And part of the reason, Jen, I think that we're talking about this week, and you're the one who said, Sarah, if we're going to talk about the work of romance, we got to talk about 50.
Yeah.
I wonder, so maybe you could talk to everybody about why this, because I do think I'm hearing you guys out there kind of rolling your eyes, groaning. Mm-hmm. I've heard from some of you actually personally, why 50 when there are so many others? And I think that Jen and I are really on the record as knowing how many others there are. And so why are we doing this one and not so many others?
Well, I think partly because of what you talked about, right? It's the book everyone wants to talk to you about when you say you read romance. I think it's very interesting as a reader to see there's a lot of animosity towards 50 Shades as being, and I think it comes from a lot of factions, right? I think part of it is, it's hard to actually name what they are because it feels unkind to people, right? I think there's, it's kind of why is this the book that's the juggernaut? It's not the Best of Us, right? From romance readers.
That's a fair point. Well made.
Say. Exactly. Right. I think there's a lot of feelings from us, the inside of romance that we are kind of unfairly burdened with this thing that's not even romance from an author who doesn't really care about us.
Yeah. I mean, we're also, it's just to underscore that. I mean, we're talking about somebody who really came from outside the genre, delivered a text that the genre has had to sort of speak to for a decade, and then left the genre, so to speak, or maybe never was here to begin with. It just was never, I think there was just very little interest in her. I don't think she ever thought of herself as part of us. I think she thought of herself as a fanfic writer who then became a superstar.
Right. So I think I think traditionally and classically, and I understand why, romance readers we really love people who kind of full-throatedly embrace us and the genre. Mm-hmm. And so I think we're always a little suspicious of this book, this author doesn't want to be ours, and yet we're told that she's ours. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, I will say, so I read this book once a million years ago. I read it again for this, and it was fascinating to reread it because I think clearly it, the billionaire romance, the BDSM was huge. You couldn't have an erotic romance without BDSM for years.
So much spanking for years. There was so much spanking.
So much, right? And then, of course, I would imagine the kink community feels the same way about 50 Shades that we do, right?
Oh, wait. This is one of my facts. But you finish, and then I'll give you the fact. Real
good. Upon rereading it, and we've done all this rereading of really classic romances from the 80s and 90s, this book is really channeling a lot of what we see in early romance, right? So the powerful master of the universe boss, the disconnect between body and mind that can only be solved by being with this right man,
It is so old-fashioned.
It's very old-fashioned.
It's wild how, as I was reading it on the reread, right, looking at it as a text,
as a book I'm reading for fun.
I remember back in the day when I read it for the first time. I've read it multiple times. And because, when you write romance novels, there is a lot. I spend probably more time than I should thinking, like, how did that happen? How did that, why that book? Why, how do I do that? Right?
Right.
And so back in the, but I remember back in the day thinking, like, this is a Harlequin Presents.
Yes.
Like, it's just a very big Harlequin Presents.
With way more fucking.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, obviously. But right? So it's a Harlequin Presents, but then, but, you know, flabby. It's three books long. It's 300,000 words or however many thousand. I mean, it's so, there's a lot in there that could probably come out. But at the same time, it's a book that now reading it in 2020, I mean, how many times have you said, like, oh, generations in romance, they move so fast. Like, there's no book that I feel like I have read, and we have read old Sandra Browns. Mm-hmm. We've read that, we did that, the Vivian Stevens episode where we read, you know, the original Jane Ann Krentz's of hers and other books. Like, I have never felt, I think about Nora Roberts' Born in Ice. Mm-hmm. Like, we've read some old books on yes. this podcast, and none of them feel so old-fashioned like this.
Like this. I mean,
it's
these
so old-fashioned.
These books, the books they most powerfully reminded me of were the ones that we read with Steve Amidown that Vivian Stevens acquired.
Yeah, but even this, like, it feels like, it feels like you're reading something from the 1800s. Like, yeah. The way he talks. He's yeah, supposed totally. To be 29. I mean, right. He was born in 1981.
So that's a part, I think, that I don't want to, like, discount, that it's really harnessing
yep.
the kinds of stories. I mean, like, I remember in high school watching Pretty Woman and my English teacher being like, I can't believe you guys love that movie. It's ridiculous. And I was like, shut up. The heart wants what it wants. Mm-hmm. And I felt like this very similarly is, you know, there's something, like, it's really tapping into something, I think, really primal about the way society has socialized women to think is care.
Yes. And I mean, it just feels so one-sided.
Well, by design, though, in the writing.
Well, no. I'm not talking about it being on. I mean, the writing is first person present, right? So
sure.
We're never in his point of view. And, you know, we were never in lots of her. I mean, this is another reason why it's very old fashioned. Like,
right.
It feels like you're reading an old historical in the sense that, like, we don't understand the hero. But the relationship feels one sided. It feels like it is.
It's so patriarchal.
She exists for his pleasure. And what's interesting is that in the last 12 years, we have read a lot, or not 12 years, but in the last whatever decade, we have read a lot of BDSM, right? A lot. And now there is such a real care taken in so many of these great BDSM books to discuss why the submissive characters' needs are taken care of. Like, for their own pleasure, right? Like, how this experience does not exist for the pleasure of the dom, but for the pleasure of the sub as well. And often more for the pleasure of the sub right. than the other way around. And I think, you know, this is why the kink community was so up in arms about, like, sure. how irresponsible the representation was. I do want to say that in the immediate year after 50 Shades was released, the number of Americans requiring emergency room care for injuries involving sex toys has it doubled.
Yeah.
And that is a really interesting, like, I think there is a lot to be said for how this book impacted people in real life. And, like, we talk so much about the expectations that romance sets and the ways that we want the text to impact the reader. But, like, this book made America more kinky.
Right. Right. Which,
that's wild.
It is. And that's the part about it. I guess here's the other thing I think I think that's a positive, probably good thing, right?
Yeah,
overall.
Me too. I'm not arguing that, but like that's the data point. That and an article that I remember reading in 2012 saying that like Bloomingdale's couldn't keep gray silk ties on the shelf, which always made me laugh because I just envisioned all these poor men coming home from work and having their wives be like, "I bought you a gray silk tie," and then being like, "Now what do I do?" And there's a great line. Were you a Sleepless in Seattle fan ever?
Yes.
There's that great line where Tom Hanks is like, "I guess I have to get out there." And Rob Reiner is like,
"Tiramisu."
"What is tiramisu?"
"You'll find out."
"Well, what is it?"
"You'll see.
Some woman is going to want me to do it to her, and I'm not going to know what it is."
"You'll love it."
And I think ultimately what I hope is other like positive good is that it brought people to romance, right? So I don't ever want to be like mad about 50 Shades.
I'm not mad about 50 Shades.
I think it's fascinating. Like I think I'd started reading it and I texted you and I was like, I am fascinated reading this.
Same.
An anthropologist,
this book gives me a great deal of joy because of this, because like what on earth? And like, I think, you know, you and I have talked a lot about like, I think it's a lot of things. I think it's packaging. Like sure. That was the first time aside from Twilight that we just saw that like, black cover with a tie, black cover handcuffs, black cover mask. Really beautiful. Like the perfect packaging plus timing, which I'm going to keep coming back to, plus this idea in the world. Remember, like in 2010, we were coming off of a massive recession. Women had borne the brunt of that recession.
Right.
They called it a he-cession for a reason. Men had lost their jobs at an alarming rate in comparison to women.
Which is now it's the opposite, by the way.
Yeah, of course. Well, because now there are children on the line, right? So in that sense, what women were experiencing, like, so a lot of women were bearing the like financial burdens of a home, of a family, and still all the emotional burdens, and still like wishing that they had time for themselves, wishing that they were able to, you know, do everything perfectly.
Yeah.
And in comes this hero who takes care of everything. That contract is like, I'll put food in your fridge. I'll make sure you have a clothing budget. You have to exercise. You get to exercise and be healthy. You get to, you know, whatever.
Get some sleep.
All you have to do is, like, have orgasms.
I was thinking, like, okay, one of the things that I, as a woman, find the worst is dealing with anything with my car. Mm-hmm. Right? Like, I have to go to the mechanic. What a pain. What if there are jerks to me? By the way, I love my mechanic. If you're in Chicago, Ashland Tire and Auto, they're amazing. They never treat me like I'm a jerk because I'm a woman, right? But, like, going, selling your car, buying a new car, the part where he sends his man off to, like, sell her car for her.
And buys her safe car.
There's the fantasy, right? You don't have to deal with the car salesman. Let me take that off your plate.
You don't have to deal with anything. You don't have to deal with grocery shopping, with your bad boss, with your car, your junker of a car. There is power in that. And we have seen that over and over again in romance. That plays out in romance all the time. But the one thing that feels really old-fashioned is he doesn't seem to take care of her emotionally.
Oh, not in any way.
Right? He is the emotional, like, he is emotionally stunted. And she bears the full burden of emotion in this.
Yeah, I mean, this is a very, I mean, this, it's like June Cleaver, right? Like, the on page, their relationship breaks down in a way that made me feel like I was watching 1950s television, right? And not television about the 1950s, not Mad Men, right? Like, actually, like, you know, these, and except for the sex part, right? And I think that's the part where I was thinking a lot about the scene where he figures out she's a virgin. Because
I like that scene a lot, by the way.
I actually am going to tell you, I think there are two really brilliant scenes in this mm-hmm. book, and they are about sex. And the first one is when he discovers she's a virgin. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, the scene at the end. And part of the reason it's so amazing is in this really patriarchal like system I have described, right, that we are socialized into in many ways still. women's virginity is this like prized thing.
Yeah.
And it is nothing to him. He views it as a nuisance. Like, I guess we got to get this over with.
He's shocked that she hasn't had sex before, but he's not like, oh, I win you now.
No, right? And I, you know what? I think after decades of like sort of wars about women's sexuality in 2010, mm-hmm. I bet I was like, well, look at this little cocktail that's being mixed up here, right? Which is you can be emotionally capable and find a man who maybe isn't, but he's going to take care of you, but he's going to bang you into next fucking week and he's going to be great at it and he's not going to care about who you've been with before. Like, it's a really interesting, like, graft
mm-hmm.
of sort of this new sexual, like, new politics of sexual revolution on top of very patriarchal structures.
Yes, because the reality is that, oh, that contract. I keep going back to that.
Oh, the fucking contract.
I hate that contract so much.
Fascinating that they put that all in the fucking book, though.
Oh, I mean, what? It's amazing. I will say this. I reviewed Gray for the Washington Post when it came out. Gray is 50 Shades of Gray told from Christian's perspective, not Anna's.
Is it like 5 pages long?
Well, it's still Twilight fan fiction, right? Like Stephanie mm-hmm. Meyer had written, what's it called?
Midnight Sun.
So, and that, if you remember correctly, when Midnight Sun was first announced, it was back in the day, and then it got released online, and she was like, well, I'm not going to publish it then.
Right.
So I assume, you know, E.L. James is clearly a massive Stephanie Meyer fan, and was like, I'm going to do that.
Sure, right? Why not, right?
It's like, she's a completist. So Gray came out, and I reviewed it, and Gray does not have the contract in it, but does have the complete background check on Anastasia in it. Like, absolutely, like, a formal, like, document from the public, from the private investigator. Like, there are so many things about this book that are wild. Like, right. I would never. I would be like, everybody will stop reading when they get to this.
I got to the contract and I was like, wait, oh, it's still going. Oh, there's
more. But also, can we talk about things like, Anna is expected to not have other partners, but there's nothing in the contract that says Christian won't.
Of course.
Right? Like, but then, of course, like, you're expected to just believe that Christian would never.
Right.
And so there are these really interesting, but Anna never has that question. Like, there's just so many things about it that sort of underscore this kind of old school, really old school, impenetrable hero who does not show at all on the page that he cares for the heroine. And then you are expected to divine this from moments along the way, right?
Right.
You're expected to divine it from the scene where she says, I'm a virgin. And he's like, well, let's get this out of the way. But he's like, I'm going to make love to you tonight.
Right.
And so as a reader of Romance Forever, I know that that means
he loves her. Right. Exactly. Right? Or he goes to see her when she goes to see her mother.
Yeah. Right. Or like that. Yeah, I mean, there's so much about it that we're like, it's so old-fashioned. And you think to yourself, like, did E.L. James read romance novels? Because a lot of this is coded in.
Right.
But then it doesn't seem so.
I feel like she reads culture. I mean, I really do. I feel like
old-fashioned culture. Like, I feel like she's, like, there's a reason why. I mean, sure. I want to talk about Thomas Hardy, too, right? What a choice.
Yes. But, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, right? Like, it's everything about this is coded as old-fashioned mores, new-fangled sexuality. Even to the point where can we talk about Mrs. Robinson for a minute?
Yep.
Because of all the things I had completely forgotten, and is he was essentially, you know, Anna's point and my point of view as well, right, is that he was molested, abused. And yet I will say, like, even recently I've seen this in books where you know, a man discloses that he had a lover when he was a teenager who was much older. And even on Twitter a couple weeks ago, there was some kind of singer, I forget his name, who talked about essentially named, like, yes, I was an older woman took advantage of me. I was sexually assaulted when I was a young boy by a woman who was older, and I was a teenager. And a lot of people were commenting, like, it's so rare that people name this. But there is a way in which I was fascinated by the fact that, like, here this is in this book that's 10 years old, and I've never heard anybody talking about, like, ever talking about it when they talk about 50 Shades. And it was one of the most interesting things that I read in the book was their disagreement on what that meant for him.
Yeah. I mean, here's the thing. I have not ever been in a fanfic community, so I don't know this to be true. But I believe that the way I understand it is that in fanfic communities, like, everybody reads each other's stuff. Right. And so I actually think that what 50 Shades represents from 50 Shades likely pulls from many different worlds of Twilight fan fiction. Right.
Sure.
So you feel like there's the old fashioned, like, Edward historical feel.
Right.
And then there's the dark taboo feel that we see. So we see, we can point to other people, right? Like, I can point to Tara Sumi and say, like, Tara Sumi's work, it does the hard work of doing taboo, like, doing dark romance, right?
Right.
And then there's, like, those emails, the, like, first, the emails are so clever, like, the back and forth between them. They're best, for me, they're the best part of the book.
Yeah,
and,
me too.
And that is categorical. They are the best part of the book. And you sort of think, well, Christina and Lauren came up through there. Like, they're funny. Like, they're light. Like, maybe there's, you know, there's inspiration taken from all of these different places, which is why I'm really excited about having a real conversation around how fanfic results in romance novelists. Because I think we all are inspired by each other in romance, right? I think that part of it is that, and maybe this is part of why the book worked so well for so many people, is because it cast this massive net.
Yeah, like, right. There's something for everyone here.
I don't actually think that, like, the book did not, there are many, many things about the book that do not work for me. But I still read it all the way through to the end, and not just because it was work. And I think that for people who want it, for women who had never really explored any thoughts about kink because they've never been allowed to, it gave them a little taste of that. And, like, there was a little taste of, like, imagine if you had a husband who, or partner who, like, cared for every aspect of you. Like,
imagine you had all the money you wanted.
Imagine you were super rich. Imagine you got the job you wanted whenever you applied for it. Like, imagine, like, you can imagine yourself. I just did a panel with Tracy Livesey, and she said that one of the reasons why the heroines of romance have become so strong, like, one of the reasons why the heroines are so great now is because they're when you put them up against heroines from, like, old romance from, like, the 70s and 80s and even 90s, right? You see a group of heroines in those books that are very sort of flat Stanley.
Mm-hmm.
And you can like project yourself into those books.
Well, and that's what I wanted to bring up, right? This is, like, a sort of famous early take on romance. And you know what? I'll see if I can pull it out of it. It's in that.
Are you talking about Kinsale?
Yeah. Is it right? The self-insert, essentially, right?
But, like, she says you self-insert as the hero.
Well, but so I'm thinking of the Jane Ann Krenz, like, the 20-25 year old book where it's, like, a bunch of authors and
the book is Dangerous Men, Adventurous Women.
Yeah.
And there is a very famous Laura Kinsale piece in that about how many people believe that you self-insert as the heroine, but she believes, and this is unsurprising for people who are Kinsale fans, shout out to Kennedy Ryan and Kate Claiborne, she believes that when you self-insert into a romance novel, you self-insert as the hero. It's fascinating.
It is fascinating because I don't self-insert as anybody. I'm like, just tell me a great story.
But do you self-insert on a flat heroin?
Well, that's the question. I think, by the way, this is, I hear a lot about Twilight, that one of the, canonically what people say is, well, you know, all these girls read Twilight and they became Bella. And I think that this is like sort of a similar, like Anastasia Steele is really pretty, there's not a lot of there, right? It's just, she has her inner goddess and her subconscious, her devil and her angel on her shoulder.
By the way, I have still not seen these movies, but I am told that the inner goddess and the subconscious are not their own characters. And that, I think, is a misstep.
Well, but you know what? It's fascinating. It really, I was reading it and I was kind of like, wow, this is a lot, right? I would say for me, when people sort of talk about the bad writing of Twilight, I don't know what they're talking about because.
No, we've talked on this podcast that we don't think Twilight has bad writing.
No, but
Twilight's a great read.
I do. Well, that's, I think, there's a difference between bad writing and a bad read.
Fine. I don't know. I mean, maybe. I don't know.
I don't know. I mean, I guess I'm just saying, though, the thing that didn't work for me, well, present tense is never going to work for me, although I'll talk about that in a minute, too. The devil and the inner goddess and the subconscious, I was fascinated by all of the verbs that, the inner goddess doing flips
and
ballet and pirouetting. And I was like, okay, that's a lot for me. But you know.
Also, I had this moment where I was like, it just feels like once it starts, it's so obvious whenever it's on the page that it's intentional.
Of course.
Like,
sure.
I think it's all intentional. And I think it is, like, it does add a certain level of, like, what the fuck is going on? And I think, like, as a reader, I don't know. I don't understand this book. I don't understand why. And I mean, like, I want to be really conscious. I want to say out loud that, like, if you love 50 Shades of Grey, like, that is absolutely great. I'm really glad you have a book that you love this. Like, if you are one of the people who, like, loved every second of it, couldn't wait for Grey, like, we are here for you. Jen and I are here for you. And I hope you are listening to us with, like, open hearts, because we are just trying to unpack how this book gets 150 million readers worldwide.
Here's the thing. I think the thing that's really interesting about the inner goddess subconscious and also the present tense, which we all know I don't like. Mm-hmm. In a weird way, though, this book really commits to it in a way that I like. There's a lot of scenes where I was like, I don't know why they're here. But one of my biggest, like, kind of meta, my own brain, I'm not talking about it in, like, the real way, I'm talking about my way of understanding present tense, is, like, when I go through my day, I don't know what's important or not. Shit just happens. And at the beginning of this book, there's scenes where she just, like, calls her dad and goes to work and nothing happens. It furthers the story in no way. And I was like, why are these scenes here? And I was like, well, if you're gonna, like, really follow through on present tense, that kind of makes sense. Like, I called my dad. I went to work. These things happened to me. But I don't know how they fit into the story of her love affair with Christian. And when the inner goddess appears, I feel like it's a clear narrative reason. It's her trying to make sense of her own feelings. And it made sense to me that there's a way that we all, like, self-talk, right? There's a way we talk to ourselves about, like, how do we understand what we're feeling right now? And maybe I thought it was silly, but I ended up being like, I get it. I get what she's doing here.
Yeah. And I think there's something really real about it in a way that I think readers might have been drawn to. However, I do think that it's important for us to talk about the fact that this book puts sex on the page early and often.
Oh, yeah. I was like, wow.
As somebody who cut my teeth on romance and, like, has certainly read, like, I mean, I read Bertrice Small back in the day. So, like, this is not a surprise to me. I think that I know that I sound like a broken record here, but packaging matters. And, like, reader and the Kindle matters at this point. And this was very much for the reader who didn't read a ton of books all the time, but had just been given a Kindle. Like, this book opened a door to sex that no other book has ever done. And on top of it, like, aside from, like, making... Look, here's the truth. Romance doesn't have 150 million readers worldwide. These are not all romance readers. They did not come to it because it's a romance novel, all of them. They did not stay for it, many of them, right? This book gave them access to kink.
Yeah.
Problematic or not. Like, it gave them access to fantasy that no other form of media had, like, been and no other form of media had been shoved in their face the way this was in some ways. Like, and I think, you know, you talk about the history of this, at the time the Times was writing, like, you couldn't open the Times style section for weeks without there being a story about 50 Shades of Grey. You know, book clubs on the Upper East Side, which, for those of you who are not New Yorkers, like, that's where the posh people live. Really rich ladies were all getting together for 50 Shades of Grey book clubs. And, like, there's just something in the DNA of this book struck a really powerful chord.
I think one of the things I would say is, although Anna, I don't know, has a lot of ambivalence about Christian's kink, there's no ambivalence at all about how great the sex is otherwise, and how much she enjoys it, and how much he enjoys it, and how fun it is for them.
And do you think that that's enough?
I think that maybe for a lot of non-romance readers, it was revolutionary.
I think so, too.
And I don't want to discount that. I think that's pretty great.
And I think what's really interesting about it is, so we know from data that obviously, like, it made women largely, although I'm sure there were men who read it too, it made women largely, like, more adventurous with sex, because we can tell by injuries in the emergency room that more people were trying stuff.
Yes.
Right. I mean, we know that also true also because, you know, there's a picture in the Washington Post article. We'll put it in show notes. That Babeland carried this book.
Mm.
You know, a lot of sex toy shops carried 50 Shades. I remember walking into Word bookstores in Brooklyn, which at the time had a tiny little romance section, like, way in the back of the store. And they had 50 Shades right on the front, right on the front. It was in every airport. It was everywhere. So it sort of became a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Well, and, like, God, you buy vibrators at Target now.
Here's the thing. If it's on the front desk, if it's on the front table at your bookstore, it's in on the, like, spinny rack right inside the door at the Hudson News in the airport.
Right.
Like, and then you open it up and it has unabashedly pleasurable sex in it. Like, what it is actually doing for women is somewhat empowering.
Right.
And it's normalizing it. Like, it's okay for you to have orgasms and enjoy it.
Right. Right.
Which is powerful stuff.
And that it's your partner's responsibility to attend to that at
but
some
here's
level.
The thing.
Right?
I don't just want to talk about 50 Shades this episode, and we're already 50 minutes in. But, like, because I want to talk about the impact of it, right? Like, I want to talk about the ripples. And the ripples are supremely good bondage books, like BDSM books, that really treat it. The BDSM lifestyle with thought and care. I'm thinking about people like Tiffany Rice.
Oh, yeah.
And Ilya Winters. And,
I mean, any number of people. I mean, it's really, right? It's like, I don't even want to list them because it feels
No.
It, like, blew the door wide open for that.
For thoughtful, like, we did a whole episode about Nikki Sloan. Like, really remarkable work around the lifestyle. In response, right? Like, in this sense of, like, you all don't actually know how good it can be.
Right.
Right? Like, let's lead you down this path. And then I want to talk about the fact that, like, you know, it also opened the door. It normalized fan fiction as a legitimate way of succeeding. In romance.
Indie romance, right? Self-published and indie romance is...
Everybody in indie romance saw an opportunity to put their stories into the world. packaging, we saw this packaging, this trim size, the whole, I mean, like one might argue like the trade trim size comes from this. Certainly the trade trim size for erotica and erotic romance comes from this. And truthfully, I gotta say, in the world, a wider willingness to discuss sex without it being taboo.
For everyone that read that, I mean, for romance readers, maybe this isn't revolutionary, but this woman's point of view about her sexual journey.
I know, Jen, but like first person present, this is it. Really, we should have done an episode about Twilight, because I feel like it took YA and it made it romance.
Although it's interesting, Twilight is first person, but not present tense.
Oh, is it not present?
Mm-mm. I checked this week because I was curious about that as well. I don't think it matters. A lot of YA was present tense and still is. And so it merges those in a lot of interesting ways, I think. And she's pretty young. I mean, right?
Oh, yeah, because she's not even graduated college at the beginning of the book. And he's 29. So, yeah, I mean, they're young. And at the time, it also, like, all the publishers sat up and took notice, and suddenly new adult was a thing, which is not a thing, you guys. New adult is not a thing. It's just contemporary romance with younger characters.
Right.
Like, but, like, what's amazing, and I, as a romance evangelist, like, it feels like what it did was open readers' minds to this idea that all these other writers were doing the same things, but better, right? Like, doing young characters, but better. Doing sex and kink, but better. And that is largely because, let's be honest, this book tries to do too much. But I don't actually think it's trying to do anything.
That's the part that is really fascinating to me, I will say, upon the reread. I was like, there's not a lot of plot, and there's not even really a lot of tension. I mean, I guess the tension of the contract and will she or will she not sign it really is like the real dilemma of book one, right? Like, they're like, yeah, we really like each other and we have great sex. We're going to keep doing it. The contract itself, I think, is...
No, she sort of waves away the contract because she doesn't... And I mean, this is smart in a sense, right? Like, she doesn't want to lock Anna into this, because once she's locked into this contract, the power is almost unwritable, right? Like, it becomes too one-sided.
But I mean, if you were going to point out, like, what is the plot of, like, where's the tension or conflict in this book?
Yeah.
It's literally like, is she going to sign this thing or not? I mean, for me, because will she agree to his demands, really? But I think the thing that's also really interesting is how much it feels like she was harnessing things that were, like, she caught an early wave.
I mean, it's luck too, right?
Of course, right? She's just the first surfer on the wave.
It's the right package, the right time, the right place. It's luck. It's just like the Da Vinci Code.
Right. You can't pick juggernauts, right?
Right.
Like, why did everybody watch Forrest Gump or whatever? Right.
It's, I mean, lightning strikes twice in this. So, I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I guess I thought when we said we were going to record this that we were going to crack the code, but we're not cracking the code.
I don't think, you know, it's funny.
I don't know that there is a code.
I don't think so either. There's a really interesting book I checked out of the library and then I didn't read, but I want to read after we recorded, because I wanted to sort of just like come with my own ideas, but it's like 50 writers on 50 Shades of Grey. And I was like, I'll be really interested, because it's a lot of people.
Are any of them romance people?
Yeah, no, a lot of them are, right? And it was Cecilia Tan put it together.
Oh, I like her very much.
Yeah, right. So I'm sure it's going to be fascinating. But I was like, you know what? I want to really bring my own, like, ideas to it. But I think, here's what I think. This is... I don't think it's necessarily doing anything revolutionary like you. I think it's just like timing.
Yeah.
But I do think that it's really harnessing a really powerful story. Like I said, that like women in particular in America, I don't know, maybe it's a worldwide juggernaut, but it seems very American to me as well. If the American dream is like this sort of renegade hero figure. I think a lot of women are socialized to think, can I draw that man's attention? Not, can I be that person myself?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Christian Grey is the Marlboro Man, right? Christian Grey is, I mean, right? He's all of those things. And I think that that's the part of it that's like really fascinating to me is all the things we can project onto him are just as interesting as all the things we can project onto her.
You know, I was talking to Eric about this yesterday because I was like, I'm just on the reread. I'm even more confused mm-hmm. about this, right? Because for many years, I have given a lot of interviews about 50 Shades. And I have always said the stuff that I said earlier about timing and like, you know, why women want this. But reading it now, and part of it is time. Like, I actually don't think 50 Shades stands a test of time. Like, I think it is a talk about a book that is of its time.
Right.
I don't think it is like, you know, over the last year, over season two, we read a lot of books that blooded us at very specific times in our life. Right. And I think some of them still worked really well for us, like Judith McNaught. And some of them didn't work as well for us because it was a different time. And this feels like if it came out today, it wouldn't.
I'll be curious if we have listeners who have read it for the first time. So
yeah. Oh, yeah. Tell right? us.
Then I think it'll be really interesting to hear what they say. So I really want to talk about the ending because I actually think.
Yeah.
Now, again, I believe that she wrote this all together and just chopped it up. Too. Right. Mm-hmm. And I mean, sure.
I don't. And when I say I believe that, I mean, I believe it happened. Like, I did not look at Wikipedia today, but I'm pretty sure that is what it was.
So here's my thing. This was actually a really satisfying ending for me because I think they are fundamentally mismatched. His kink to her feels like hitting. I think it's really interesting that she says that over, you just want to hit me. Like, and I was like, it's not really hitting when it's consensual and you're both into it. Like, that's not the word you would use. And she, at the end, is like, I think it's actually an amazing scene at the end, by the way.
Oh, me too.
It is a fantastic
because
scene.
It's very rewarding.
Yes.
He finally gets what he deserves.
And here's the part. Her walking away at that moment, I was like, this is right. Like, he's never going to be right for you. What he needs, or I guess my other understanding is, in this situation, if they wanted to remain together because of their emotional attachment, he would just need to find other people to, like, have that kink with, right? That found it just as rewarding. Mm-hmm. But that, of course, that is not going to work in a romance, right? Necessarily. It would now, but it wouldn't then, maybe.
And to be fair, the next two books bring us around on him.
See, and I was like,
end of this trilogy, and I have said this to 1,000 reporters, but you can't look at it just as one book because there's no HEA. Like, as a trilogy, it is a romance novel. Currently, it is not a romance novel. And this is the book that made E.L. James a superstar, not the other two.
Right. Oh, yeah.
This is the one. And Amazon announced at some point that it had sold more copies of 50 Shades of Grey, book one,
yeah,
than it had of any Harry Potter book.
Wow.
Right? So.
Yeah.
That said, a lot of people, I think, finished one and they were like, that is a full story for me.
Yeah. Right?
Honestly, could conceivably live happily ever after that.
Can I ask a question then? So how is this problem, this fundamental mismatch of their, like, sexual needs resolved? Do you remember?
Yeah, well, they don't ever sign a contract.
I mean, I'm really bothered by, like, the hitting language. Okay.
Well, in 50 Shades Darker, which is the second book in the trilogy, he can't deal with not having her. Classic romance hero move, right?
Mm-hmm.
So he goes to her and she sets the rules, which is no rules. One, like, I'm not signing your shitty contract, and no punishments. And so they move forward, but there's still kink. I mean, like, the friend finds the contract and, like, you know, there's a lot of back and forth. And then she discovers, and then ultimately, like, they continue to have kinky sex, but it's not as intense.
It's not punishment, right? Which was the deal breaker for her.
Yeah, I mean, like, one of the big things about it is, like, there's sort of a sense, and as somebody who is, I want to make sure that I'm respectful of the kink community I'm not a part of, right? So I don't, if I say this wrong, please correct us on Twitter or wherever. I know you guys will. So, but my understanding is that like, the biggest issue with these books is that, like, the perception of kink as wound that must be healed.
And that, right, absolutely.
And, like, that's a deeply problematic way of looking at somebody's sexual identity.
So can we talk about the scene at the end, though, of this one? Because,
yeah, I would like that.
You know what? You cannot like 50 Shades of Grey. This is an amazing scene, like, truly. Mm-hmm. Because basically what happens is she says, let's try it then. Like, if this is so important to you, let's try it. And she hates it. Like, she is harmed by in this scene, right? She is harmed by him, but she doesn't use her safe words, but she's like, I'm going to try it. Like, I'm going to give it my best shot. Right. Like, this is what's happening. And there's this really amazing when it's after the, it's like 6 lashes, I guess, or he at the belt. And when it's over, he goes to comfort her and she views it as like phony. Like, you just hurt me. You don't now get to comfort me. And she says, is this what you want from me? You want me to be like this? And it's such a fundamental, like, at that moment, I was like, there's no future for them, right?
They are not right for each other.
Right. And her walking, and then she, her walking away was a satisfying ending to me because I thought, well, these two can never be happy, right? But I thought this moment where it's like, I'm going to try something my partner is really into. And he fundamentally misreads her. And she offers to do something she doesn't ever want to do. And that felt like a moment of, like, vulnerability that I tremendously respect, actually, to put mm-hmm. something like that on page.
I agree. I just think it's really hard, Jen. It's hard for us to have, I think this conversation is difficult because there are 2 more books in this series, right? So, like, you know, the problematic piece of this being about kink being pain or kink being, you know, problematic and you having to cure it in some way, right? Like, that perception. It's underscored by the history of Christian's kink, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which in 50 Shades... Breed, the third one, it becomes clear that Mrs. Robinson, whose name is Elena, that Christian has this, like, terrible mother who's a drug addict and can't take care of him. And he had this, like, horrible childhood and was ultimately adopted by the Trevelyan Greys. Right.
Right.
Which is Edward. Right. From.
Sure.
Right. And he's adopted by them. And then to get over his issues relating to his childhood trauma, Elena teaches him, like, he becomes Elena's sub and teaches him about BDSM as a lifestyle. And then Anna is like, well, if that's part of his whole, like, ability to heal from his childhood trauma, then I'm willing to, you know, be a part of it. And it's really problematic, right? And I think I said I didn't want to talk too much about the books because I actually think, like, when we talk about 50 Shades of Grey, unfortunately, we are not talking about the problematic shit that is in 50 Shades of Grey. We're talking about how 100 million readers, like, clearly it resonated with them. But I don't think that it resonated. I think on the one hand, you can't talk about it as a romance without talking about the whole thing, all 3. And on the other hand, you can't talk about it as a juggernaut when you're talking about it all three. You have to only talk about the first one.
It's
complicated.
It is. It's this very interesting, like, hybrid kind of beast, right? Like, it's got all these things going on with it. But I think the part about number one, right? Like, just talking about it as it is, well, at the end of...
Sorry.
Okay, we talk a lot about romance, like, both interrogating and, like, winning over the patriarchy. Mm-hmm. When Anna walks away at the end of book one.
Yes. Say it. Yes. That's what I was going to say.
Right?
Yes.
It is, to me, winning over the patriarchy.
Yes. That it feels rewarding to readers who have been fucking, like, shattered by patriarchy their whole life. And, one might add, over the last 2 years during a recession.
Like, sure.
It feels good when she leaves.
Yes. It
and
feels
I mean,
great.
Like, so maybe it's just a real, real smart place to end the book, right?
Well,
like,
and this is where I want to go back to Twilight, because the thing that's really interesting about Twilight is Twilight ends with them together, and it's at the beginning of the second Twilight book that they break up, and then there's this amazing moment where it's like months go by, and it's just blank pages, right? And I, to this day, I know that's fucked up, but I will never forget reading that, right? Exactly. Here, it's a different thing, right? Where
she cuts it in a different place.
Yes. And so this is why I was like, I'm perfectly satisfied with her saying, not that it's like Christian is a bad person, but that what Christian needs is not what I need, and we cannot give each other and we'll never be able to give each other what we need. I have to be strong enough to end this.
Right. So and it's not a romance.
Right. And when I went to the beginning of number two and read that, like, within 5 days she took him back or whatever, I was profoundly disappointed that she could not stick to her guns. And in that way, I think it harkens to romance tropes, but without rewarding romance readers in the same way, at least at that moment.
Yes.
And that, I think, is probably why a lot of romance readers fundamentally struggle with this book as romance, because it isn't following the romance.
It doesn't deliver it.
It doesn't deliver what we want. Yeah.
I mean, the first book does not deliver it.
Right.
But it delivers to romance, the genre, legions of new writers who do figure out how to deliver it.
Yep. Yeah.
And legions of new readers.
Yes.
Who are looking for, I mean, like, this is the other thing we don't talk about a ton, but, like, the difference, the Venn diagram of indie romance readers and traditional romance readers does not overlap very much. And this is part of why I think Fifty Shades delivered a lot of digital readers to erotic romance that never came over and, like, never walked into a bookstore to say, like, what do I read next?
Right.
And so I think a lot of what erotic romance did was deliver, I mean, hundreds, if not thousands, of writers who just evolved the genre so fast.
Right.
And so well. You know, what's interesting about that is that, like, at the same time as this was, like, shattering everyone in the whole world, Cressley was writing IAD, which we know is super sexy. J.R. Ward was writing Black Dagger Brotherhood. We know that was super sexy. Like, Sylvia Day was writing. Like, there are a lot of people who were writing pure romance with lots of sex in the world. Tell me why IAD is not the book that was the juggernaut. Because I think we both agree that that series is one of the greatest romance series of all time. It's just really difficult to, like, wrap your head around it. And I don't know if it's, I mean, I know it's timing, but I want it to be something else. And I don't know that it is.
But I do think, too, like, we are talking about Twilight and IAD and all these juggernauts that were paranormal. And it's like it really is taking those paranormal tropes, mapping them along, like, the Harlequin presents, right? Like, it's all the intensity, especially the sexual intensity between them.
I really wish she was willing to talk about it. In my experience with E.L. James interviews, she doesn't like to talk about the process at all.
Yeah.
And, like, I would, like, if I had a chance, and look, the reality is, Jen, like, we just blew our chance to ever have E.L. James talk to us. Like, she doesn't like criticism, and I get it.
Well, she's laughing all the way to the bank. It's fine. She was never going to talk to us anyway.
Exactly. So, but the reality is that if I had a chance to talk to her, I would really enjoy it, because I would like to know, like, were you a Harlequin Presents reader?
Right.
Like, did you know that's what you were doing? And I'm really interested. Like, I'm interested in, like, did you know?
But how could you know? Like, do people who write juggernauts know?
I don't know. You know, I think about Julia Quinn, right, talking about how she sat down and she sort of read a bunch of historical romances and, like, mm-hmm. mapped out how you craft a historical. And then she wrote her books.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people do that. And that's a very valid way of doing it. It's the way people learn to write screenplays. So why not learn to write any genre that way? I wonder, I think part of it is that when the juggernaut is yours, you don't even know.
Well, of course, right? Of course.
So, but the most important piece of this, and I think the reason why we wanted to start the season with this, and then we'll wrap up, is that we felt that you couldn't really talk about modern romance, meaning we spent two seasons, we spent the first season talking about a series that we really love that we think, like, is, like, a master class in what romance can do and how romance should be written, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then we spent season two talking about the books that taught us what romance could do as a reader. And now season three is about where romance can go. And I think starting with 50 Shades was really smart because it sets a line in the sand as, like, this is a watershed moment from which the genre is about to just explode.
Right. I mean, it's generative, right? In that sense, right? I mean, and when we think about all the things that it has, right? It's like sex, power and relationships, class. I mean, you know, like women versus men's roles and relationships, friendship.
And it's not alone. I think that's the other thing, Jen, that's so important for us to say. Like, we said it before. I want to say it again because I know you guys are going to say it on Twitter and I want to have it said on recording.
Yeah.
We know. It's not the first one, it's not the only one, but it's the one that sold 150 million copies. So, like, it's the one we're talking about because when we talk about this one, we're not talking about the book.
What are we talking about when we talk about 50 Shades of Grey? We're talking about, right, like, people in the world and women and sex and their lives. And modernity.
I mean, like, I don't know that she intends for any of that shit to be in here. Like,
right.
I don't know. I can't. Sometimes I know, right? Like, sometimes I can see it in the bones of the book. Like, oh, she meant for that to be there. But, like, he's so fucking old-fashioned. And when she leaves him at the end, you're like, yes.
Right.
That's what I wanted. Put patriarchy away. Close the door. Let the elevator doors close on it. Like, I think there's also something, like, the one thing I really do love is the use of elevators in this book.
Yeah.
Like, I like that finally she, like, gets in the fucking elevator and leaves him and says, like, I'm closing the door on the past. I'm closing the door on fucking Thomas Hardy and I'm opening a different door. It's triumphant.
I think her leaving him at the end is the
right ending.
It's the right ending. And I think it's also part of what makes this book a great book, to be honest with you. I mean, I love romance and I love the HEA, but her walking away at the end was great. It was great for me.
It gave a lot of women a sense of power. Literal love him and leave him.
Yes.
Which men have always been able to do. And I just think, like, I think it's important for us to realize that, like, romance took that and just exploded it. And we started to see that kind of freedom in heroines over and over and over again in different ways.
Yeah, right. And I think that maybe is really what makes it.
I mean, but we saw that before, too.
I don't know. I mean, again, like walking away from his money and walking away from the great sex and walking away for all the things he could do for you. Because you knew deep down in your heart that, like, it wasn't going to work between the two of you. That's a power move. It mm-hmm. is.
And the exploration of that move, like, we saw so many other writers start to really, like, unpack each of the power moves that are, you know, each of the threads that are in this book. That is what is remarkable about what came from 50 Shades. Like, there was such a power. We go back to, remember, I don't know if I said this on the recording or to your face, but back when we were doing, like, the early books in season two, I said, like, I sometimes wonder if, like, Joanna Lindsay would write a book and then Jude Devereaux would pick it up and read it, and then she would sit down and she would write a book, and they just, like, and then McNaught and Garwood would do the same. And so they were just, like, constantly trying to, like, one-up each other. And I think that romance has always been iterative. I think all the time about, like, I wrote the Casino series because I read Black Dagger Brotherhood. We are constantly having a conversation with each other as we're reading and writing. And the books are evolving and changing and inspired by other people and the work that they're doing in the genre and the places that they are lighting, like the places where they're turning on the lights. And I think a lot of the books that came after this, in indie romance especially, were iterating the unique pieces of this puzzle.
It's hard that is an outsider book.
Absolutely.
In the sense that, right, like, that author doesn't really want much to do with us.
Absolutely.
And some of those readers don't. And, yeah, right, and I think that that's a lot of the tension around this book in romance. Is why is this the book that we have to deal with?
And we do. Look, the reality is, writers, like, I get it. I get it. More than a lot of people, I think. Like, I get asked about 50 Shades every time I do an interview. Every time. And every time I talk about the history. And, like, hey, you know what? We are coming up on 50 years from Flame in the Flower. Guess what? Publishing, like, media is going to pay attention, and 50 Shades is going to be front and center again. And we're coming up on 10 years since 50 Shades. Somebody's going to do the story. Like, get ready. It's happening. I get what you're saying, and I don't like it either. Like, I want her to show up for romance, because a lot of us showed up for her.
Right.
But at the same time, she didn't come from here. She didn't go here. And also, that's why I want to really honor people who do go here, who came from that world and have been here for a long time. And I think also, you know, later in the season, we're going to read Outlander. And, like, that's another person who we as a genre, like, that's another book that we as a genre get asked about all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And she has explicitly said, it's not a romance.
And yet.
And yet, we still have to play in the pool. Romance is tricky. It's nuanced and complicated. And it is really hard when you say, we have spent 90 some odd episodes talking about this and go and saying, like, we never want to speak to one book. But this one is kind of a different story.
My final thought is, you don't have to like 50 Shades, but rereading 50 Shades is fascinating.
As a text.
As a text.
It's like an archaeological dig.
Yes. And if you have it in you to approach it that way, I think you will find it a rewarding experience, because I certainly did. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is the part that then is interesting, is you're like, why is this here and who is it speaking to and what is it doing for us and what did it do for romance and what does it say about women and America? I mean, there's so much that's like in there. And I really think if you can bring yourself to it with that lens, as opposed to like, is this a good read? Did I enjoy it the same way I'd enjoy just picking up a book I wanted to read for fun?
Yeah.
It was fascinating to me.
Yeah. I don't think this is a book that somebody in 2020 picks up and says, like, this is exactly the book I'm looking for. I think, as a new reader, like, I think this is a comfort read for a lot of people, surely.
I could see that.
I do, however, think that if you have spent two seasons with us, it is a fascinating book to read. But all of that is to say that we are not going to make you do homework all the time. And our next read is not homework. It's fun. Tell everyone what they've won, Jennifer.
It's Millavane's Heart of Blood and Ashes. We talked about it on the summer reads, and then sort of halfway through, we were like, you know, we have a lot to say about this book. Maybe we should do a full episode. And it's also like a fantasy romance, really different in terms of what it's trying to do. It came out earlier this year.
Is bananas.
It is bananas. It is
a 5 bananas out of 5 read.
Yes. And it's long. It's 500 pages, so you're going to want to
get reading.
You know, get reading.
Also worth, if you are somebody who needs content warnings, you should probably check Goodreads.
Yes, for sure. There's some violence on page, and I think people would maybe want to know about that. So yeah, I'll see if I can find a review that has a particularly good list and link to it in show notes for this week.
I'm really excited about it.
I am too.
Mila tweeted at us last week, and she was like, I can't believe that you guys are going to do a whole episode. And I was like... And she seems nervous. She shouldn't. Mila, you should not seem nervous.
We loved it.
We loved it. It will not be like this one. I don't think we were mean, though, here. Like, I think here's the other thing. Like, E.L. James, if you're listening, like, honestly, I think, like, it's such a cultural text at this point. Like, there's just nothing mean to say about it. Like, it's just, it stands apart from everything else.
Yeah. And you know what? We might not have figured out why, but I think we talked a lot about what it does do.
I don't think I ever will. Okay. I go to my grave not knowing.
I mean, I feel the same way about Forrest Gump. So what can I tell you?
Right? Why did we all love that movie?
Yeah.
I mean, I think there are a lot of them, but it's interesting because, like, you know, we talk about Da Vinci Code, and I know exactly why Dan Brown is great. I know exactly why he works. And I just, you know. Anyway. Well, so Millavane in 2 weeks. Let's do it. That is Fate of Mates for the week. You can buy gear from Jordan Dene or pins from Kelly, best friend Kelly, if you go to our website, fateofmates.net, and click on merch. There you will also find transcripts. We are produced by Eric Mortensen. What else do we have to say? Oh, I have a book coming out. You guys, I accidentally wrote a contemporary novella while I was under quarantine. It's set in England. It's a secret Duke story. It's in an anthology called Naughty Brits, which is coming out September 15th. So you can see if I can pull off a contemporary.
She can. She can. P.S.
That's really nice.
She can.
And then I think all that is left to say is laters, baby.
Are you rolling your eyes at me? Oh, amazing.
Have a great week, everyone.
Hello, Fated Mates. My name is Darcy, and the book that blooded me was Pirate's Princess by Constance O'Banion. It came out in 1989 when I was 15. When I was a little kid, I loved books, you know, like bedtime Dr. Seuss type stories. And then as I got older, somehow I just kind of got lost. I know there are books out there for older children and preteens, but I just couldn't find them. Then my brother started to encourage me to get back into reading, and he gave me a couple books. They were The Hobbit and Pet Sematary. So, you know, very different from romance, and they really weren't my cup of tea. So one day, I'm all with my friends, and we just wandered into the bookstore, and I picked up this book. I have no idea what drew me to it, or, you know, maybe I just saw Romancing the Stone. Maybe I had a surge of hormones and was drawn to the couple on the cover having sexy times. I don't know. But I bought it, and I just devoured it. Now, it's important to me not so much for the book itself, but for the fact that it was my gateway into romance. I haven't read it in years, and honestly, I don't remember it in great detail. I'm sure it's problematic because, hello, 1980s. I do remember that they were foster siblings, so that can make another ish. And he's a ship's captain, not a pirate, no pirates in this book. But his family is successful in shipping, so, you know, that could also be an issue. And she's a lost princess from some made-up tropical kingdom island, despite the fact being a blonde white girl, so, you know, there's that too. But it was full of adventure and romance, and I just loved it. And I started reading romance as fast as I could get my hands on them, and I haven't stopped since. So, thanks